Good morning, good afternoon, good evening and good night. Wherever you are in the world, you are very welcome to this week's episode of Ireland Creates, the podcast all about Irish storytellers. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and each and every week I bring you an artist from a new genre, from a different part of Ireland perhaps, but most importantly, a different storyteller in each and every episode. You are listening to Series 3. If you are new here, you are most welcome. Please do go back and listen to our back catalogue of episodes. I'd like to take a moment to say thank you very much for all the kind messages and support since the launch of Series 3, featuring our very first live podcast event. And I have to say, I really thoroughly enjoyed presenting the podcast to a live audience, and I hope that we can do that sometime again in the future. I'd also like to take a moment, because I think it would be remiss of me not to acknowledge the tragic incident in Chríslaw, County Donegal, last Friday afternoon, and those 10 beautiful, precious lives lost. And of course, our thoughts and prayers are with them, their families, their loved ones, their friends and the wider community. And indeed, our thoughts are with those who were injured on the day, those who were made homeless as a result of the tragedy, and the wider Chríslaw community. I know it will be a long, hard road ahead, and a very difficult time ahead as you now begin to gather and come to terms with what has been an horrendous couple of days. But continue we must, and on this, our second episode of Series 3, we are joined by a visual artist, most known publicly, I think, for her photographic work, but who is a multimedia artist, and one that I think you will thoroughly enjoy hearing from. This is her story.
My name is Roisin White and I'm a visual artist. I work with photography, sculpture, recently textiles, and I'm also a facilitator, working with young people and children through all different types of visual arts.
Well, Roisin White, you are most welcome to Ireland Creates. This is our third series now of the podcast. I have been watching your work online for quite some time, so I'm delighted that we were able to find a time suitable for both our schedules to have our chat today. I want to go back, I suppose, a little bit, because I think, and most people would know you as the artist that uses photography, but I know your, even your qualifications are broader than that. So where did this all begin?
I guess it probably began when I was a teenager, and I couldn't decide between fine art and photography. And both my parents went, oh, don't do photography. There's no money in photography. So I studied photography, as did they. They both studied photography. My dad was actually one of my tutors in DIT. And I had a great time.
Must have been interesting.
It was totally fine. I think I was a bit of a brat, testing the boundaries a little bit at the beginning. But then we worked very well together. We get on really well. So I studied photography at DIT for 4 years and I really enjoyed the course. I got a huge amount out of it. But I think as I came to the end of it, I realized that I wanted a bit more of an expanded practice. Throughout the program, I was, you know, bringing in elements of collage and using different materials and really wanting to make, to me, the work always had to be more than just a print. That idea of the artist's hand being very visible was really important to me. And I wasn't satisfied with a straight print. So when I finished, I went and did some of the evening courses in NCAD. I think the first one I did was sculpture and drawing. And then I took ceramics. I did a short course with the Dublin Print Studio, doing etching. I kind of like trying most things once. So in the last few years, my practice has definitely become far more sculptural sometimes, you know, not even using photography in the finished work. And then it's now in the last sort of 9 months, really expanded into working with textiles. I started making quilts and making quilts using photographs, and that has become my main love of 2022.
And having parents who had studied photography, like many of us, our parents wouldn't have been involved in creativity in any way, really formally, you know. So kind of there's a part of me that wonders, God, you must have had a really fabulous childhood surrounded by art and creativity. But yeah, what was it like having parents with that kind of a background?
Oh, it was brilliant. I mean, you know, growing up in a house full of makers is wonderful. In our old house, you know, we had a great big dark room in the garage. You know, not many people can say that their birthday photographs with their friends when they're seven are taken on a 5.4 camera. So it was pretty special. But it was brilliant, you know, when I was thinking about going to college and, you know, working on a portfolio. I did a portfolio for photography as well as doing one for NCAD and applying for fine art, even though I kind of knew if I got it, I probably wouldn't accept the place into fine art. So it was great being able to show that work to them and sound off with them about what, you know, what might work in their opinion. And being able to contrast that with what my Leaving Cert art teacher was telling me, which was, this is terrible. You probably won't get into college with that portfolio. So it was really, really nice to, yeah, have people around me that I could talk to about it who had a bit more authority maybe than, or whose opinions I respected a little bit more than maybe my peers.
Yeah, I always feel Leaving Cert art versus becoming an artist are not necessarily aligned with each other. Not having taken Leaving Cert art because it just didn't match my subjects and timetables didn't match. As a teenager, I was always jealous of the students who got to take art. But now in hindsight, I realise I probably would have driven the poor teacher around the bend. Because, you know, I probably wasn't going to be the one that got the A1, the Leaving Cert. I was probably going to focus just on making stuff. That foundation, though, that you got in DIT, like I know the photography program in DIT, of course, it's now the Technological University of Dublin, but their photography course has a fantastic reputation. And I know many people who've gone through the course and would always speak very highly of it. I'm curious, what do you think makes it so special? What gives it that credibility in the sector?
I guess for me, I think one of the things I got out of it the most, which I really did not like at the time, was there's a real focus on sort of photographic theory and visual studies and really interrogating your ideas and having to be able to stand by them. I mean, it was by no means easy. It was really challenging, and not everyone enjoyed it or even might have that opinion afterwards. But it set me up, I think, really well for what came afterwards. You know, always knowing I wanted to be a fine art photographer, not a commercial photographer. It meant when I was suddenly on my own to start those big projects, I had a really good grounding in how to research and how to really be able to back up my ideas and talk about them in a way that I don't think I would have had I not, you know, studied it so intensely. And we worked on our projects were quite our final year project in particular, they were quite durational. They, you know, you really had to work on them for a long time. I know for the graduate project, you know, you're working on it for nearly a full year, which you'd never.
Yeah.
You know, you'd never would have worked on a project that long before you got to that point. So even that was great when you get to the next stage. And writing a thesis, which I remember going, oh, I'm doing a visual arts BA. Why should I be writing? But I don't know if this is that idea of second degree fun where it was awful at the time, but you look back on it and it was wonderful. But I got so much out of, you know, getting to pick the subject, the topic for my dissertation, and just getting to research it really intensely. And it was on my terms. I had a wonderful thesis supervisor who I desperately wanted to impress as well. But it, again, that's another thing that really set me up for life after college.
And in that period, like, even the work that you share, like if you only focused on the work that you share on online with people, I think it's fair to say that you have quite a distinctive style. Was that coming through at that stage? Or, like, you know, how do you go about for people at the early stage of their own careers? How did you go about creating or identifying your own style?
I feel like I hear that question asked of people like illustrators a lot, where they have to find, you know, they've got to find their own line, find their voice. I have never thought about it in terms of photography, I don't think, before. I think the biggest thing for me was just, you know, taking in as much photography as I possibly could. The biggest shift for me was when we were in third year, we do a module on the photo book, which I was so excited about. I felt that was more important than even considering going on Erasmus. The photo book was going to be what I wanted to learn about. And that was a whole new way of experiencing work and being able to see work in, you know, a full body of work that you wouldn't be able to see online. And, you know, we have great institutions and galleries in Ireland that show photography, but not in the volume that, you know, you might experience in other countries around the world. So suddenly you have this influx of all this information. And 2000 and when was it? Sort of, you know, some 2010 onwards, the photo book was really having a moment. So there were lots of incredible mm-hmm. books coming out. And there was one book that in particular by a photographer called Christian Patterson. It was called Red-Headed Peckerwood. And it was the first time I'd ever seen photographic work that was in conversation with things like found materials and ephemera and like bits of paper with text written on it and photographs that were, you know, coming from archives or coming from flea markets to tell a story in a way that was more than just the single image. And that kind of lit a fire under me. It was the idea that you can blend very different styles. You can pull from different places and being really playful with that idea, which I think set me on a path. And that entirely came from just looking and experiencing as much work as possible, but not only photography. I think, you know, we can learn so much from other mediums as well, which definitely gave me that mm-hmm. hunger to want to learn other things when I finished. And I think, you know, you can learn a lot from seeing something you really like and then trying it out yourself, not necessarily copying. But it's an idea of, I wonder what that would be like if I did it. And you're the one who's doing it, so it'll always be different to the person you're trying to emulate. And that was very much, I think, how I started on that path. Just being really curious about, you know, if we put these two things together and they're now in a conversation, what does that say? And that's kind of how I think I went about other projects.
How important is curiosity in your practice?
Oh, it's huge. And I think a lot of that is also down to how much I work with children. It's so delightful to see, you know, their ideas that come out of a very simple prompt that, you know, me as a grown-up, I never would have thought of. But I, you know, my studio is pretty chaotic. There's stuff everywhere. There's stuff on the walls. There's piles of things around me. And just being curious of, you know, what if I mixed this material with this other material? What might that be like if I turn that photograph into a table? Just that kind of playful. It's that thing of like, what if, you know, what if I took those plants that are taking over my window And I used those shapes as a way to look at a two-dimensional object, you know, cutting things out, weaving them together. It's trying to be playful. I think curiosity and playfulness go hand in hand.
So then, because you're not just using, and because you're not solely using photographs or photography, that because you're drawing in so many other areas of practice, when it comes to, say, a new project or a new piece of work, where does it start for you? How do you approach it?
I think it starts in my notebooks. I always have a notebook on me. I could go 3 weeks without opening it, but it's always there. It's this sort of omnipresence, this heavy thing that's in my bag all the time. And, you know, looking back at the 3-4 major projects I've done in the last couple of years, they entirely started in drawings in my notebook.
Okay.
And even these might be very photographic works. It always comes from little doodles in the notebooks. Maybe there's one photograph I took offhand that I've printed out, stuck in, and then thought about, oh, what if I draw on top of this? Or how do I feel about this drawing or this photograph, and what kind of drawings come from my curiosity about that single image? As an example, in January I took a class in quilt making, and I was working on a commission using lots of photographs I'd taken in Portugal, and I didn't know how to put them together because the final images had to be square, which is not a format I tend to use, and all of the photographs I'd taken were, weren't that ratio. So I just started cutting them up. It started with just cutting the tops off the portrait images to make them square. But then I started piecing them back together in this way in my notebooks, really crudely cut and snip and stick down. And I realized what I was doing was I was making tiny quilts out of the photographs, just like I'd been learning the same week to do on my online quilt making class. But I never would have done that if I'd just been using Photoshop. It was only the act of, doing it in my notebook, because if it's in my notebook, it doesn't matter. It's just getting it out on the page. And then that ended up being the entire format of how I finished that commission. I did every single one in my notebook using, the photographs printed on just regular printer paper. And then I would remake them in Photoshop, trying to get that awkward line that you only get from using a scissors, and tried to match them.
Sounds incredibly an intensive way of working. I'm just thinking about the level of detail that you're going to, and then recreating that in Photoshop. I'm nearly getting a headache here as you're describing it, but the results are fabulous. It's clearly working for you, that this approach that you take to your work and practice. Talk to me about Lay Her Down Upon Her Back. I think that's when I first became aware of your work, and this, like, black and white, your drawings are included in it, and this way of approaching photography, but also adding something extra in there. What for people who haven't heard about that particular body of work, what is Lay Her Down Upon Her Back?
So Lay Her Down Upon Her Back was a project that I began in, I think it was 2017. I was on a residency in Cowhouse Studios. It was the How to Flatten a Mountain residency, which is a photography residency that was organized with Photo Ireland. And I really needed to break that way of making work that I had in college, where it was propose an idea and then deliver it. I was seeing these photographers from all over the world having their work was being made in the other way. They were being playful first and then realizing what it was about. So I tried to emulate that. I just wanted to, take photos and see what happens. And I just kind of went to the body. I ended up taking a lot of self-portraits, doing different things, you know, covering parts of my body, generally covering my face. And I kept this up as I went home after the residency. And one thing that I kept coming back to was this idea of, you know, what do we think of with the female form? What different connotations do we have of a typical female body lying on the ground, lying on her back, essentially? And I was thinking about sort of submission and intimacy and sleep, and you know all the things sort of going from, you know, going for your smear test to, you know, lying down and having sex, like, and everything in between. So this was an idea that I just kept pulling at. And then I was thinking about that idea of, kind of outdated, but it still gets said, you know, oh, she's, you know, she's taken to the bed, you know, have some rest, you'll feel better, which is often said, you know, on your period or something, or, but it's, you know, it's women's things that we just don't talk about. And
it's it's secret code. We dare not say what she's actually doing. We just use the code.
Absolutely. Yeah. And everyone knows what that means, but we won't say it. And I was telling this to my cousin, who is not an artist. And this is the reason why you should talk to other people other than your artist bubble about your projects. I was explaining this work that I hadn't got a hook for yet. And he just turned to me and went, oh, yeah, just like that story, The Yellow Wallpaper, which I'd never heard of. You know, he's an English professor, so he's a vast knowledge of literature. This is a short story by an American author called Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And essentially, it's a story about a woman who is given, is prescribed this medical treatment of the day, called the rest cure. And she's sent to her attic bedroom, and she's only to be visited by the doctor. And this room is filled with yellow wallpaper with this incredibly detailed pattern. And she starts to see things in the walls, see things behind the pattern in the wallpaper. And then this builds and builds until she eventually pulls all the wallpaper off the wall to try and find this figure. And it's kind of this catch-22 story. It's like, well, was she going mad and that's why she was sent for this rest cure? Or was this treatment actually what drove her to this kind of insanity? And I was reading more and more about this rest cure, which was a pretty widespread treatment, kind of from the 1880s, 1890s onwards. And it involved a catch-all treatment for basically anything that was wrong with a woman. Hysteria would be one of those big things, but it would have been...
You know, why actually investigate the issue? Why not just, like, you know, put her to her bed and sure, be done with it?
Exactly. So hysteria would have been one of them, but I think at the time they would have called it, she's suffering from nerves or nervousness. But as well, mm-hmm. you know, it would have been things like anemia or postpartum depression. There was a term I read in a book where the woman was described as bloodless, which is a horrifying idea. But the treatment was enforced bed rest for a number of weeks. It could be anything up to 3 months is what some of the accounts I read of. You were to be fed a high-fat, high-protein diet. So that was things like up to 12 eggs and just plain, like, a kilo of beef mince or something like this. That was all you were given to eat.
Oh, my God.
Because the idea was kind of the larger you were, the healthier you were. Then you were not allowed any stimulants. And stimulants were considered things like reading and sewing. Anything that, you know, might be slightly exciting. So you were to be flat on your back, fed, nothing to do. You weren't allowed to see or speak to your family, and you couldn't have your family nurse because it was seen that they might be too soft on you. You even had to ask for permission to be rolled over. You weren't really truly supposed to be resting. And because of this, you know, your muscles would start to atrophy. So the doctor would have to give you massage. And then when this was seen to be too strenuous on the doctor, it was turned to electrocution. So your muscles would be gently electrocuted to stop them from atrophying. And this was a huge treatment. It was given, it was, now it was When I say huge, it was huge in the middle and upper classes because you had to be able to afford a personal doctor. And, you know, this went on until the 1930s when it was discredited as not working. But I was recently just looking this up. I was checking the name of the person who came up with it. It was a man called Cyrus Weir Mitchell. And I found an entry that said that despite it having been discredited as having no evidence that this worked at all, there were records that this was being used as a treatment as recently as 1996. And which is
really
very recent. Yes. I knew that unusually for the time, this was a medical treatment that originated in America. Usually medical breakthroughs or new ideas originated in Europe and then traveled over. We were just slightly more ahead, I guess, this side of the pond. But this originated in the US and then was sort of brought to the UK, where it was used exclusively in the field of obstetrics, which I guess has some basis as a usage. Now, that was more exclusively the bed rest and you know, certain types of diet. But this idea, I think, still resonates. You know, we, as we just discussed, you know, you're still expected, or it's still seen as, you know, acceptable to say, oh yes, she's just taken to the bed, and that's and we'll say no more of it. And discussing this this treatment and the way that we can still see this resonating, talking about this with friends and colleagues and peers and talking about it publicly, anytime I've discussed this, someone has come up to me after a talk or, you know, even just chatting in the pub and go, oh yeah, something similar happened to me where I went in with this problem. You know, it could even be into A&E with a problem that is exclusively for people with a uterus, and they're not believed. It's downplayed. You know, we have plenty of history of histories in Ireland of things where women's maladies are not taken seriously, that they were mistreated purely by the basis of their body. So while the rest cure was this very old treatment, there's kind of been ramifications in the way we think about women's healthcare since then, and long before that as well. This was just one specific example. So in all of this reading, I guess to get back to the artwork, in all of this reading, I was finding photographs that kind of displayed this kind of this sort of mistreatment of women within healthcare. And for a long time, I've collected medical textbooks. I think the earliest one I have is from the 1930s, and these would be heavily illustrated books to show, you know, this is the position that you hold a woman to get her into bed, or these are the best ways for the physician for the woman to give birth, so that it's easier for the physician to see the birth canal, despite the fact that it's definitely not the comfortable position for the person who's giving birth. So lots of these kind of examples. So I was pulling out those kind of imagery and those types of images and making my own work in response to that research and those images. So there's kind of a dialogue between the here and now and the work, the images and the stories that I was reading about from the past. I'm often asked about the fact that the time period in which I made the work. I was working on this project throughout the campaign to repeal the Eighth. And while I know I don't actually discuss abortion healthcare at all in the project, it's very hard to deny the fact of what was happening in the background, what was happening in Ireland at the time, the conversations we were having, and just a general discussion about autonomy within healthcare for everybody. So it's definitely rumbling in the background.
And whether or not you were deliberately trying to discuss it in the work. It was the only discussion happening really in public at that time. And, you know, subconsciously, it could be argued that maybe you were influenced unbeknownst to yourself. The work itself, like, why was it important for you? Like, I know in some of the images where, like, your face is not showing, were you trying to represent every woman or maintain some level of privacy, or where did that come from?
I mean, it's no secret that all of the photographs, all of the contemporary photographs in the project are me. I guess the reason all of the photographs are, I don't call them self-portraits because they're not about me. They're photographs depicting a female body that I had that was available to me for the photographs. You know, there are positions and there are, you know, there's nudity and there's things that I just wouldn't feel comfortable asking a model to do. I know what I'm comfortable putting on film. And I would just feel incredibly uncomfortable asking other people to do that. But there's a playfulness and there's a working things out in front of the camera that I can also have so much more control of when I'm just doing it in my studio when the idea comes to me. I don't tend to photograph people other than myself, and it's purely out of I'm available at the drop of a hat. So the reason this kind of, you know, I wear wigs or I hide my face is really just because it's not about me. It's just that, you know, I was available.
And obviously, you know, there's a lot of research that goes into your work, and that all takes time. Like you mentioned the residency there, and we've spoken before on the podcast about the importance of artists having access to residencies. But, you know, doing projects like this takes resources. It takes you to have the luxury of time. How difficult is that to achieve in 2022 Ireland?
It's incredibly difficult. I mean, the entire period that I was making that work, I was working full time or close to full time. So, you know, it's your evenings and weekends, which can be really hard to manage. You know, it's, you know, you come home from your day job, you have dinner, and then you do a couple more hours in the studio, which is, it's intense. And I have daylight balance lights in my studio, so it completely tricks the circadian rhythm of my body where it thinks it's still the middle of the day. So I very frequently am kind of accidentally working until 2 in the morning because of the lights in my studio. Sometimes intentionally, of course. But it can be really, really hard to prioritize. You know, if you're prioritizing studio time after your day job, you know, something else is falling away. You're definitely not relaxing enough. You're not taking down. You know, I've been privileged since then to be able to devote more time to it. But, you know, there's also trade-offs to that. You know, I'm able to devote a bit more time to my studio practice, but that's because I live with my parents. You know, it would not be a possibility if I was having to rent an apartment and rent a studio. I don't know how anyone affords both in this city. So it's, you know, there are trade-offs, but it's, I'm definitely happy in being able to spend that extra time, in the day to day.
You mentioned earlier on that you work with children and young people. What exactly does that involve?
So I worked for years with the ARC in Dublin, which was, I mean, I'm still there, but in a different capacity. That was the most incredible experience. I started off as an intern and I ended up there for 6 or 7 years. You know, I was working as a workshop assistant, working with different artists and working in a front of house role. And it was incredible. I always knew I liked working with young people. I was a scout leader for years. But this opportunity to essentially shadow an apprentice with different artists who specialized in working with young people across all different fields. It wasn't just visual arts. It was theater makers and musicians and dance artists, and learning from them. And everyone has a different approach to working with young people. And I don't feel like that's an opportunity I would have got anywhere else. You know, there is obviously benefit to, you know, doing higher level education in working with young people. But this kind of work experience essentially was so valuable. So that now, you know, I'm working with schools, I'm working with youth groups. We do a call out. I work with children in all different capacities, kind of everywhere from age 5 all the way up to about 24. And it's just so exciting. It's a challenge. It's absolutely a challenge. But I get so much out of it. You know, once you're in the room with them, you know, it's who knows what's going to happen. You have to be flexible and be able to think on your feet a lot, because you can go in with a plan and can completely go out the window within 10 minutes if the group just aren't into it. And they'll tell you, it's very obvious. So it's like, it's a really intense planning, so that you have, you know, idea A, idea B, idea C, and then being able to blend them all if you've got a group that need that have those kind of different needs or energies. And I think, as I was saying earlier, you know, that playfulness, that curiosity, those ideas that we just don't consider or give the time of day, that they just get excited about and just go right down that path, because why the hell not, is a way that I try and bring that back into my own practice.
I had to laugh there when you were saying about young people telling you what they think and whether or not they're into it or not. Like, it is blatantly obvious if they're not. And that can really strike terror into the hearts of many people who work in education in general. But it sounds like, you know, it's more than a job for you, that you get an awful lot out of it yourself personally.
Absolutely. I mean, I really don't think you could work with young people if you didn't, you weren't really passionate about it, because it, you know, it takes your full self when you're in there. And I mean, another thing that I've really taken from my time at the ARC is how valuable it is to actually just ask young people's opinion, ask them, you know, what did you think of that workshop? You know, being really open with them at the beginning, going, if I say something that you don't agree with, just call me out on it. Like, I'd rather have that discussion and be totally led by their interests than say, no, we have to stick to my plan and I don't really care what you think of it. It's a challenge for you. And the other thing that I've been called out on before is, don't ask them to do something you wouldn't do yourself. I mean, don't ask a child to stand up and sing if you're not going to do it as well. And I had a group of students call me out on that when I said I was really terrified of oil painting. And they were like, you said you wouldn't ask us things that you wouldn't do yourself. And they sat me down and made me do an oil painting. And it was terrifying, but it was such a good wake up call to remember what it was like to be a student.
Yeah, I can only imagine, because I teach myself. So no one's ever tried to do that with me in one of my classes. And I hope none of my students are listening now and they don't try it themselves. But it is a good one. Yeah, you don't ask what you won't do yourself. And maybe a motto that more of us should live by, Roisin. What are you working on at the moment, may I ask?
So I am jam-packed with projects with young people at the moment. We're working on 3. I'm working on a wonderful program that D-Light Studios are hosting, and we were very lucky to get Arts Council funding for this, where we're working with a group of teenagers from Dublin One, and we are working on a kind of a 2-month program where we just give them a really broad overview of photography. We're in the studio once a week for 2 hours, and we're learning about, or they're learning about, different styles of photography, very much looking at the idea of storytelling and representing their community in a way that they see as, you know, a correct or a fair representation. And they, it's, again, it's very much, it's being led by them, what they want to photograph, what they want to tell, what they want to show us. And at the end of that, we're going to have an exhibition in Delight in November. I'm also just, I'm about to start a project down in Cork with Greywood Arts, as well as the National Space Centre, which is really exciting. We're going to be working with a couple of local schools and their youth club to make make work throughout a number of workshops for an exhibition at the end. And I didn't even do science in school, so it's been a huge learning curve for me. But it's really exciting to kind of think about visual art and space and using photography as a tool for that. Kind of the only physics I know is the physics of light and how that impacts photography. So that'll be
I had really no idea that we had a National Space Centre.
I kind of knew. I didn't know a lot about it. It's down in Middleton and Cork, and I've chatted to a number of the staff members, and they're lovely.
Okay.
And then I'm working. I'm working on some work for an exhibition. So it's actually, it'll be running alongside that exhibition in Delight Studios that the young people will be presenting their work. So it's a really nice opportunity for the young people to have kind of, you know, have their artwork on show in one space. And then there'll be an exhibition of sort of, want of a better word, professional photographers alongside it. So, you know, they'll get the kids will get a really great audience to their show. And for that, I'm working on a set of quilts. So it's two kind of almost queen size quilts. And the patchwork on the top is made of it's made of photographs that I've printed onto fabric, and then lots of color blocks that are entirely made out of fabric that I've gotten secondhand shops and charity shops. It's mostly bedding, things that people throw away and a lot of people feel a bit strange about buying. But I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to be as sustainable as I could to make these. And those two quilts, they essentially represent the 2 years of the pandemic. The first quilt is March 2020, using photographs from March 2020 to March 2021. It was a time that I didn't feel like I could be creative. I didn't feel like I was being creative. And then I started looking back at those photographs that I'd taken on my phone. I'm always taking photographs on my phone. And I realized that there was actually a lot of stuff there. So the first one represents that first year, and the second one represents that March 2021 until that point in which Micheál Martin declared the emergency was over. So they work as a set, as a way that was a way that I could kind of come to terms with the last 2 years, and working with a soft material, a very soft practice. You know, you're working with fabric, with lovely cozy cotton wadding, and just a really meditative practice of quilting. You know, quilting is the stitching together of the three layers. And I opted to do all of this by hand. You can do it on a sewing machine. I don't think my sewing machine would be up to it, but I was delighted. It was a part that I didn't think I would enjoy, but actually spending weeks hand sewing these quilts has been really cathartic and a really nice way to spend my evenings. You know, sitting there under a blanket making a piece of artwork has been a really lovely experience. So I'm working on those at the moment. The second one is almost finished. And yeah, they will be in Delight Studios in November.
Well, I can't wait to see that in Delight in November. And like you work so hard. Your work ethic is very clear in what you do. And then there's a part of me that wonders, where do you get the energy from?
Where do I get the energy from? I don't know. I think I just go a million miles an hour and I don't know how to slow down. I definitely say yes to things more than I should, but they're usually things that I really want to do, and I'd be sad if I didn't get to do them. So it's, you know, I think I'm running on empty a lot of the time. I wouldn't recommend working as much as I do. But it's how I work. And, you know, getting to spend my evenings on my own practice is really enjoyable. You know, getting to step away from the emails and the applications and the workshop preparation and actually just sit down and, you know, do a little bit of collage, which always leads to something else, or often leads to something else. That bit doesn't really feel like work.
I have to ask, your Instagram handle, how fascinating. Where did that come from? I've always wondered when I see you pop up on my feed. I'm just wondering what's the story behind it?
I love telling this story. So when I was in DIT, had a wonderful lecturer called Tony Murray. And I think it must have been in first year, where we were just getting into our, you know, our notebook practice, and, you know, we're all sort of stumbling around, not really knowing what we're doing yet. And a lot of us were pretty stuck. And he sort of said, you know, don't think of them as, you know, if you get something wrong, don't think of it as a mistake. You know, don't think, oh, that's terrible. I'll never make art that I'm happy with. He just said, look at it. Just take a moment and say, how fascinating. You know, taking those things that go wrong and, you know, instead of being devastated, just taking it as a way to learn something new. It's another bouncing off point. You know, that didn't work, but now we know that doesn't work, but maybe we can use that for something else. So it must have been, it must have been around then that I set up my Instagram. I had that how fascinating written on the front of one of my notebooks for about 2 years. And it's always kind of stuck with me.
Does Tony Murray know that you've co-opted his lecture into your Instagram handle?
Oh, he absolutely does. And that's why I'm so proud to give him that credit.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Ireland Creates today, Róisín. And I'm going to finish up now by asking the question I ask all my guests. What does storytelling mean to you?
It kind of means everything. It's very much the way I make sense of things. It works throughout, you know, my practice. You know, if I'm working on a very large body of work, I will put it into a book form to work out where the gaps are. You know, if most of my projects, you know, they have to work as a narrative, as a story, to get from A all the way to Z for me to be happy that it's finished. And, you know, if a chunk of letters are missing in the middle, it won't work for me. But I've also found it's very much, it's a learning technique for me. You know, when I was doing Leaving Cert maths, my favorite part of maths was learning theorems, because unlike a lot of other things where you just had to learn it off how things worked, and you had to know that this is what an invisible number meant, but a theorem was telling a story. So that was a piece of totally unrelated subject, but that I used storytelling to make sense of. And I guess it's the way I work with young people as well. I mean, if you can take them on a journey through a workshop, I think it'll make more sense than just telling them what we're going to do. If you start off with something imaginative that you can weave throughout all of the making, I think it'll take everyone on an interesting journey.
Well, Róisín White, or how fascinating, if you look up her Instagram handle. Thank you so much for joining us on Ireland Creates today. I've really enjoyed speaking to you, and thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Aisling.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the podcast this week. If you would like to get involved in the podcast, if you'd like to nominate somebody to be featured, please do get in contact with me through my website, ashlingorourke.com. You can send me an email to info@ashlingorourke.com. The podcast theme tune is by createskill.ie and the artwork is by clairecreative.com. That's all we have time for on this week's episode of Ireland Creates. Have a great week and stay safe.